The Theosophical Society presents Will Ross in a talk entitled Riding the Ox Home, a Study in Karma.
It's always a pleasure to, I think, talk to people about theosophy, whether it be at camps or at headquarters or anywhere else. I seem to have been doing it most of my life for some reason or other, but I still enjoy doing it. And tonight I am speaking about the driving, or rather riding, the ox home as a study in karma. For I think that karma, a word which of course has become quite popular in the English language, as although it is a Sanskrit word, the subject of karma is one that Madame Blavatsky says is most important in the study of theosophy. She said all students of theosophy should study karma and nirvana. The one, you see, having to do with the whole path of life, and the other with the goal of all our experience. Now, this idea of karma is often called a law of cause and effect. And although that is a moderately good translation for it, it is not really a very accurate one. Because, as Madame Blavatsky says in The Secret Doctrine, karma is an absolute and eternal law in the world of manifestation. Its only decree is absolute harmony in the world of matter as it is in the world of spirit. Now, there is a general feeling that this law that acts in this particular way, this law, as I said, which is often thought of as cause and effect, as something which punishes and rewards us. But once again, Madame Blavatsky points out that this is an entirely wrong idea, that karma does not punish or reward. In one sense, it cannot be said to act even, since it is action itself, and it creates nothing and it designs nothing. But it is we ourselves who are caught in its action. It is what we do. It is we who plan, we who create. And this disturbs the orderliness of things. So karma acts quite automatically, as it were, to restore order. For in that sense, it is we who punish or reward ourselves according to whether we work against the laws of harmony or whether we break those laws. And of course, when we look round at ourselves and at the world in which we live, we see we are not creating a very harmonious world in which to live, so that we are breaking those laws and therefore punishing ourselves by what we are doing. The word, of course, that the Greeks tended to use for it was the word nemesis, which is usually translated as fate or retribution. But, and Madame Blavatsky combines the two words together quite frequently and speaks of karma nemesis, the spiritual dynamic effect, she says, of causes produced by ourselves. But one of the important things to realize in this is that karma does not predestine anything. As she again says, it predestines nothing and no one. We make our own future. I think this is one of the points that we must always realize, that theosophy puts the future in our own hands. It is not a deterministic philosophy, but quite the reverse. And I think one of the most important things that has been happening in modern science in recent years is with the growth of quantum mechanics and so on. We no longer feel that the world is a strictly deterministic process, but that it too operates, as it were, without strict determinism. Many people have remarked on this thing, that we no longer live in a world in which we feel if we only knew all the things that were operating at one particular moment, we could predict the whole of the future. But we allow for changes in that possibility. And the changes, of course, always lie in the mind of man, in the way he lives, in what he does. For it is his free will which creates our own destiny. And therefore, philosophy is, as it were, an optimistic philosophy, because it says that we can achieve the destiny that we strive for. Professor Feuerstein puts it very clearly, I think, in one place where he says, although the past determines the present, the future always remains open. Life is self-creative, spontaneous, not inflexibly mechanical. So that we are free, not bound by karmic necessity, if we work in humanity and harmony instead of with disunion and strife. We are bound to the wheel of fate until we act from an inner, organic, orderly sense, an orderly point of view, and not from without, from the ordinary rationalistic point of view. Now, one of the concepts that always has to do with the progress of man in the field of occultism in general, it is quite often said that we are engaged in treading the path from this world, as the Buddhists put it, from samsara to nirvana, from this world of coming and going to that world where there is no coming and going, but merely a oneness, a sense of the unity of things. And all religions and philosophies in the past have tended to give illustrations and stories about these paths. Some are more descriptive than others, but they all seem to have them. Of course, from my point of view, I feel that still the best symbol of treading the path is contained right in the phrase itself. For when we think of walking, which treading involves, you find, of course, that this is a very good example of karma, of cause and effect. For when you put one foot down, that, as it were, is the culmination of all your past walking till that moment. But then where you put the next foot down, your next step remains under your control. You can put it where you will. So I really find no better symbol than that of this particular process of treading the path. But the path itself has been talked about by all religions and philosophies, as I said, and in different ways. In the Christian religion, of course, which most of us are most familiar with, you have the tremendous story of the prodigal son. I feel, of course, in many sense, we are all prodigal sons. For the story is that the son who became rather tired of living at home with all the comforts of home, collected what was due to him from his father, and apparently with no resistance from the father at all, and went out into the far country. And he led a rather riotous life, spending his money. And then in the country where he found himself, a famine came along. And so he was having great difficulties, found life very hard, was ultimately reduced to feeding the pigs, and things were so scarce that he had to even eat some of the pig's food himself in order to live. And when he was living in these conditions in the far country, he remembered his father's home and realized something of what that meant to him. So he returned to that home. And you'll remember the story, the father saw him a long way off, greeted him, brought him home, killed the fatted calf for him. Of course, we hope it's a vegetarian calf. Everything was done to accentuate his homecoming. The only flaw in it was the brother complained. Do you remember? The other brother who had stayed at home, he said, look, I've stayed at home all these years and you've never killed any fatted calf for me. But he who has been out and done all these things, squandered his money, gained all this experience, you do this. And it had to be explained to him that he was always in the bosom of the father, and therefore there was no really any reason for this. He was always in that very honored position. Now, one thing that I always feel is a little lacking in the story, and I think, of course, in all stories there is something lacking, is the fact that there is no description of how he gets home. In other words, he suddenly remembers his home is in a far country, and there's no mention of what happens from the time he looks there and the time he's being greeted by his father when he goes back. But many of the other symbols that you find in other philosophies and others' ideas do tell you something more of that path, and I'd like to go into some of them. But first, as I said before I started this parable, we are all prodigals, because the whole idea of the theosophical philosophy, as I see it, is that we are journeying from our country of origin, from wherever it was we started, into this world of experience, into this far country of the world. And at first, of course, we are just bound up in that world and concerned only with that. And then we begin to find all the trials and the problems, they get accentuated, I think, in our modern life, of this world. We begin to look back to our spiritual origins. And so we start once again the process of getting to know our true nature, our true home, and start how to get back there. These stories of journeys, of course, have been so popular. You remember in the early romantic literature, Chaucer and so on, you will find there so many of the stories were written about pilgrimages. Groups of people who start off to go, shall we say, to Canterbury in England. They go along the road, and they stop at the inn, and there they start roistering and forgetting about their journey, and they are engaged in the life of the inn. And then they remember their journey, and they go out and walk again towards their destination. But one of the very interesting, I think, stories with regard to this is contained, of course, in the series of pictures that occur in my title, This Riding the Ox Home. This is part of the Chinese tradition, and it is very well described by Willard Johnson in a book of that same name, Riding the Ox Home, where he shows the various pictures and symbols contained in this as showing the process of meditation, that process where we discover what we are by our own inward effort and by gradual stages, as it were, come to some understanding of what we really are. But like all real symbols, they can be read in many ways, and show us certain qualities of life and experience which help us to an understanding of the process in which we are engaged. Now, the series of pictures, there are various series, 6 or 10 or various numbers of pictures, they are always drawn in a circle. Everything that happens in the pictures are within a circle. And the circle, of course, has always been one of the great symbols of the whole manifesting process. It is a whole. And perhaps more than anything else, we can say that wholeness is what we are striving for. That wholeness is reality. And the fragmentation with which we are engaged is merely the reaction of the mind to the experiences that we go through. But when we are totally aware of ourselves, then it is a whole experience, so well symbolized by the circle. Now, the first picture shows a boy standing in the countryside beside a stream with a little bridge not too far away. He's standing there holding a rope. And he's looking quite bewildered and quite lost. And of course, I think the boy is the symbol of man gaining experience. He is lost in the far country. But he realizes that there is something that he needs for getting about in that far country, that it is not just something in which he can be by himself. And so he has the rope. And so he begins to realize that this is something which is to harness an ox. And the ox is the symbol of man, the body of man, and particularly his psyche. It represents all the tremendous energies which our psychic nature has. That energy which shows forth, and which, as Madame Blavatsky says in The Voice of the Silence, brings us the blossoms of life, that under every blossom a serpent coils. This tremendous energy of the psyche is where all our problems lie. And this is really what the ox stands for in the whole series of pictures. Of course, we haven't come to the ox yet in the picture, for merely the boy is standing there. In the second picture, you will find that he's looking around, and now he discovers the tracks. He can see where the animal has been. So he sets off to follow this track. And the third picture shows him sighting the ox. He is now, as it were, able to get hold of that necessary vehicle for our psychic and physical natures, a part of the necessary vehicle by which we can explore the country and get back to our home and know from whence we started and whither we are going. So, the next picture shows him putting the rope on the ox. He's beginning to get control over it. And of course, this is not an easy process. First he gets it on, and you see him beginning to twist the neck of the ox a little, to turn it onto the path that he wishes to explore. And in the next picture, you will see that he has begun to really tame the ox. He now has the ox on the end of the rope and is leading it along the path that he wants to follow. The next picture comes along, and now he has the ox completely under control. So he is sitting on the ox and letting it, as it were, go along the road under his direction, but without having to pay very much attention to it. He has it well controlled. It's going exactly where he wants to, so he can think about other things, play his flute, and do whatever he needs to do to make this road a little more pleasant. And when he has done that, he's riding the ox home. The next few pictures don't contain anything at all, really, of the ox. The ox is the first one shows you the ox simply forgotten. It's no longer there. It's no longer needed for this particular thing. And then ultimately, everything is forgotten. You have almost a blank picture. And then finally, you see the boy, now of course with all the experience of having tamed the ox, having let the ox go was no longer being necessary for his own experience, meeting his master, that is achieving the goal, and therefore able, as it were, to arrive at that end where he comes in contact with his own inner nature and knows where he has been and what he is trying to experience. Of course, everyone will read these pictures in their own particular way, but they are all, I think, symbols of part of the same process. And to see that each stage leads inevitably to the next. In other words, what one does at one moment leads to the next stage, so that when you capture the ox and tame it, then you have achieved something which makes it a vehicle for your own experience, and so on in every one, till the end all those experiences are forgotten. They are turned into talent and faculty, and one becomes aware of the master within or the master without, according to the way you like to look at it, who assists one to really final understanding. It's a great study in karma because each picture, as it were, arises out of the experience of the preceding one. And in the end, as I said, all are forgotten. One now lives within the law, and therefore no longer bound by anything. Now, of course, there are similar ideas, similar symbols in the Hindu tradition, and they are extremely valuable. They are even more detailed in some ways than the one that I have just been speaking of. The one that is referred to in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, is the symbol of the chariot. In the Bhagavad Gita, of course, you have the great warrior Arjuna leading the head of the forces that are going into the great battle. And he has the charioteer, who is Krishna, with him in the chariot. And this chariot has always been part of the great symbology of this fight against our own lower natures, against our psychic problems, in order that we shall achieve the enlightenment, in order that we shall achieve complete control over all our principles and aspects, so that we can utilize them for our own particular ends. Now, in this particular symbology, the chariot, of course, represents the body, that which carries us around and gives us the possibility of contacting the external world. The master of the chariot, because remember, in the Indian tradition, the man who drove the chariot was not the master of the chariot. He was merely the driver. The master was the man who fought from it and so on, but he didn't have to take care of the driving. The master, therefore, of the chariot represents our own higher self, our Atma, if you like to use that particular phrase. That, as it were, stands apart from it all, and utilizes all the rest for its outer experience. And the charioteer represents the intelligence, the spiritual intelligence of man, what we would call buddhimanas, technically in our theosophical term. That element of intelligence which lies beyond mind, which is the intuitive, aesthetic experience of ourselves by which we know the truth. And it is to bring that in control of our lives that is really the goal of all this path we are treading. So the charioteer stands for that intelligence. And the reins represent the mind, for it is by the mind that we control things. And so the reins control the horses. And the horses, once again, those powerful creatures that draw the chariots, represent the psyche which man has to, and body which man has to control, which one has to bring into its service, in order that the chariot, the horses, the reins, the driver, the master, are all acting together in order that the work which they wish to accomplish can be expressed. And once again, you see, there is this symbol of learning to get the things to work together in order and in harmony. The master of the chariot, the charioteer, the horses, the whole thing must be controlled and unified so that there is a harmony in this thing, so that the work can go ahead. It is always in this sense that we see that karma is working to bring about a complete harmony of all the aspects of our life, so that we are not bound by things because we are working with things. When you want to go places, you are not limited by anything but your own power and your own control. And of course, the arena in which the chariot is used is this world of sensory or mechanisms in which we are in all engaged. That is the arena in which we are all playing a part. And to do well in that is really a mark of the man who is living effectively. And then if we turn from Hinduism for a moment and look at Theravada Buddhism, there is still another set of symbols, all of which indicate something of this pathway which man is treading, this pathway which is constantly guided, monitored, ordered by karma. And there, of course, one must remember in the days of the Buddha, the country in which he lived, the northern part of India there at the foothill of the Himalayas, up to what is called Nepal today, there was a forested, level plain, very bountiful, full of rivers and streams, and a population that was still very largely a migrant population. For except for the rainy season, the rest of the year was an ideal climate in many ways for moving around, going to fresh places where one could live as one went about. But with the rivers, of course, one of the real problems of getting around the country was crossing the rivers. And so many of the symbols which the Buddha used had to do with this crossing the river. Crossing the river of life, as it were, to get from this near shore to the far shore. And you can imagine the pilgrims on the near shore there, waiting beside the river, wondering how they were going to get across. They were quite wide rivers, And I'm sure the far shore appeared sometimes just as a line. It was rather flat country there. And they were wondering what that far country was like. And they would watch the ferry boats coming, being pulled or rowed across the river by various people. And then when one of the ferry boats came, they would go on the ferry boat. And the ferry boat was called the ferry boat of the doctrine, because the people that ran the ferry were the people who knew the doctrine. When the people, the pilgrims, went on, they took part in hauling or in rowing or poling in order to get the boat across to the other side. And when they reached that other side, the far shore, they then, of course, had achieved their goal. And in the symbology of that, there was no longer any far shore, any near shore, any ferry boat. All that was forgotten. One had arrived at the new destination in order to live the new kind of life. Or, as sometimes, the symbol was not of a ferry boat, but of a raft. You got to the river and you built the raft. And when you got on the raft, you poled it across to the far shore. And you had arrived at your destination. But you know, there were many who, when they got to their destination, they looked at this raft that they had made and they said, "Oh my, this is a very useful thing. I'd like to keep this." And they wanted to haul it out, forgetting that there was no means of taking that anywhere else. It was not a land vehicle. It was only for use in getting them across the river, only of use of getting from the near shore to the far shore. And it must be then let go in order that they can be free to live and act in whatever way was necessary in that new shore. That you cannot take with you these various things which are the means by which you may travel. They are useful for getting there. They are useful as a means for experience, but they are not to be held on to. And I think that as we begin to look at this problem of karma and the problem of our lives and what we are trying to achieve, we have to realize that in many ways that we have constantly to let go of the means that we use to help us tread this ordinary path of our everyday lives. That we build up a whole number of things that we really are part of our conditioning. Certain fixed ideas that have been useful, certain ways of life and so on that have been proved to be very valuable in gaining a particular experience. But we are all too often afraid to let go of them and to go on to something new, something different, something more enlightening. And it is this process of living and letting go which is the real mark of the travel along this road of evolution. We are so tied up by our memories that we often cannot really rid ourselves of them sufficiently to see things as they are. But if we want to really achieve that freedom of understanding, that sense of enlightenment, then we have to let those things go and begin to approach the new. What is needed in our lives, of course, is that we should try to turn our ordinary gaze and our ordinary ways of looking at things to a way of intuitive insight which shows us clearly what must be done now not in the patterns of the past, but in something which is new, spontaneous, and insightful. And this is why in, of course, the theosophical literature and elsewhere, you will find so many books dealing with this particular subject, because it indicates to us that what we know from observation and from the ordinary experiences of our life are only valuable as they are turned into talent and faculty, which helps us to approach the new things rid of all that baggage, rid of those rafts which have been useful, in order that we can face the future freely and with full attention and power. So, the theosophical concept, as I see it, is always one which says that when one is faced with understanding ourselves, one cannot judge that by what has been written or by what we have learned to believe by any of the orthodoxies or even by the books that we read, but must look at it and find it and discover it for ourselves. For our lives are our own karmic responsibility. No one can do these things for us. As I said, I feel that the theosophical point of view is essentially an optimistic point of view, because it says you have the ability to achieve the goal, to tread the path, if you will, and that no one else can do it for you. I feel that today, when we see the multiple books that are appearing everywhere, sort of easy ways of achieving enlightenment and things of this description, we have to realize that there is no easy way, that karma works to produce harmony quite impartially and inevitably. And the only way that we will be able to discover what is really valuable and useful to our own life is to be able to free ourselves from all the bondage of the past and approach things freshly and newly. When a person approaches a problem that he has never experienced before, he so often looks into what he has done and tries to find ways in which he can modify past methods to solve the new problem. But although he may produce something which is a little better, it doesn't really solve the problem altogether. It only creates, as it were, a bigger framework in which new problems arise. But when one can let the past drop and look at the thing newly and freshly, then one has a vision, an insight into a new way, a new method. One takes a different step, as it were, in a new direction. And that is that which gives us the insight and a feeling of satisfaction. And this, I think, of course, is so well drawn out in all these various symbols of the religions and philosophies, that each event, although the past, of course, brings one always to the present, that in the present, we are our own creators, our own guides. From there, we can live spontaneous, creative lives. And as we do that, so we find that the bondage of past ideas, the bondage of the fixed methods that we have always used, disappear, and we are able to be creative and whole and work in harmony with other men and with nature to produce the kind of world that we all hope to see. Thank you.